How are you doing this morning? We're trying to stay warm in here, right? Unfortunately, most of the heat usually goes up, and the floor stays pretty cold. Jim got these fans turning so that they blow the heat back down. So that should at least help a little bit here. And you can see the kids were drawing on the board here. What's that? Yeah. Mr. Stanbob is his name. There's Mr. and Mrs. Stanbob, I guess, on the board. Is that who that is? I asked the boys, I said, well, why is he so sad? You have to ask them for the answer. No, no security. Okay. I am hooked up, but I don't know if this is on. Yeah, the green light's on, so that should be good. Okay, I need you to open your Bibles this morning once again to the book of Isaiah. Look over to Isaiah and chapter, where are we at here? Isaiah chapter 7. And then you're also going to want to get 2 Kings 16. The last person out, if we can make sure that they close that door there so that the heat, at least what there is in here, does kind of stay in. You want to, looking at Isaiah chapter 7 verse 1. I say Isaiah 7, verse 1. We're going to get started right away just because we have too much to go over. Look at Isaiah 7, verse 1. It says, it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah. Now, next to that verse, you want to write down 2 Kings 16. 2 Kings 16, because that's going to be where in Israel's history that Isaiah is making reference to where he gets this prophecy. And we are going to spend a few minutes and go back to there in just a second and take a look at this. I was telling Lori again this morning that I'm having the most difficult time going through Isaiah because there's, you know, how do you decide what to leave out? This is extremely difficult, and she said we'll hit the highlights, and so the whole book is highlights, you know. So it is rather difficult. So there's a lot of things we were going to do last Sunday we just didn't get to. We just need to move on. But so a lot of going through the book of Isaiah, you're going to need to go back in your own personal study time, check the cross references, fill, you know, do that comparison, do that study, and so forth. But we are going to go ahead and move on now to Isaiah chapter number 7. So Isaiah chapter number 7 is one of the most important prophecies in Isaiah because it introduces for the very first time this prophecy of the coming of Emmanuel. If you look at Isaiah chapter 7 at verse 14, Isaiah 7:14, we're going to give you some background about this here in just a moment, but I first of all want you to see a connection all the way through chapter 7, all the way really through chapter 10 here. Notice Isaiah 7:14, therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name. There it is. There's the first time that that word as a name is used here in the book of Isaiah, Emmanuel. Next to that reference, write down Matthew chapter number 1, verse 18 to 23. And that's where God the Holy Spirit through the pen of Matthew teaches us how to interpret this verse, because he quotes this verse and applies it to the son that Mary was going to give birth to. Okay? So that's one that is introduced here for the first time in Isaiah. Now, stay in Isaiah and go to chapter 8. Watch it again. He's going to carry through this theme, Emmanuel. He's going to carry it through a little bit further here. Isaiah chapter number 8, verse 8. He shall, and again, we're going to come back and read the context. We'll point this out here, but he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land. Oh, and there it is again, Emmanuel. See that? When you read that context, you go, well, what in the world? How does that apply to Jesus and so forth? We'll come back to that. And then if you look at verse 10, it's a little bit different here. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand, for God is with us. What does Emmanuel mean? Who knows? It means God with us. See how he does, just in these two chapters right here, he takes the prophecy of the coming of God with us, and he brings that forward through chapter 8, through chapter 9. In chapter number 9, verse 6, chapter 9, the very famous chapter unto us a child is born. There's the virgin birth. There's his humanity. Unto us a son is given. There's his deity. God-man. God with us. So he's going to, and he talks about the details there. He's going to be called Wonderful Counselor of the Mighty God and so forth. And he carries that through forward. Now, fundamentally, the reason he does this at this point in the book of Isaiah, the reason why he gets this prophecy at this point, is that when you look at chapter 6, remember the vision of chapter 6 that happened in the year that who died? Who remember? King Uzziah died. What was significant about the fact that Isaiah gets this vision in the year that Uzziah, all these ayahs, right? What was significant about the fact that Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up in the year that Uzziah died? Who remembers? Well, they were. Isaiah did live during the lifetime of Uzziah, yes.
Uzziah was a wonderful
king, but he was lifted up with the pride, wanted the priest's office, and with leprosy, and died as a leper. Uzziah, of all the kings in Israel, the greatest king in terms of what they accomplished in their kingdom and empire next to Solomon was Uzziah. He brought the kingdom from a place where it had quickly gone downhill. He restored so much. Uzziah was an incredible individual in terms of what he restored the kingdom to. But the problem was, in the height of his kingdom, he wanted the priesthood also. His heart was lifted up with pride. He attempted to go in and offer burn incense on the altar of incense and was stricken with leprosy. And, of course, he died a leper. Isaiah saw all that. And it's interesting that, if you'll remember this, Uzziah, what was true of Uzziah, was a picture of the nation. God brought Israel out of Egypt and brought them to the height of their kingdom glory in the days of Solomon, up with pride, and they fell. And so Isaiah starts the book of Isaiah by declaring that Israel, you're leper. You're leprous from head to toe. There's no soundness in it at all, but wounds and putrefying sores. Remember that? That's how he starts the book. So what was true of Israel was true of Uzziah. Uzziah got to a place where he tried to restore Israel, and he did a pretty good job, but then his heart was lifted up with pride, and he falls, and he dies a leper. And so when he said back at chapter 6, he says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. He saw the Lord on the earth, the king Uzziah, but he became a leper. And it's like he gets this vision to confirm to him, listen, there's another Lord, Lord of heaven and earth, who is going to reign, is going to rule, and he's the king and the priest and so forth. So you want to put all those things together. So now, as we're going to move on to chapter 7 here, it's going to be several years down the road, and there's something else that happens now. Look at chapter 7, verse 1. And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. Okay, so Uzziah has died, and now Jotham is reigning in Jerusalem, in Judah, okay? Here's what happens. I'm going to tell you the story briefly. Here's what happens. It goes on to say, Rezin, the king of Syria. Now notice that's S-Y-R-I-A. It's not Assyria. If you'll go over to chapter number 10 real quickly in the book of Isaiah, chapter 10, verse 5, 10:5, it says, O Assyrian. Now that's two different nations, Syria and Assyria. Syria is the one that we're talking about in chapter 7. Syria eventually gets conquered by Assyria. Alright, and then Assyria eventually takes off the northern kingdom into the Assyrian captivity. Anyway, go back to chapter number 1, verse 1 of chapter 7. It came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah. Okay, here's what happens now, here's the background. Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail. Now, you see what happened is that got to get these guys' names straight here. Okay, this is a little confusing here. Okay, Rezin is the king of Syria. Micah is the king in Israel, the northern kingdom that split off, right? That, by this point, this, Israel become also known as Samaria. Well, those two nations become confederate together, and they try to take Jerusalem. So you can see that Jotham is in a world of hurt here, because he sees not only Israel, the king of Israel, which is Pekah, who's taken confederate with Rezin, king of Syria, and they're coming to take Jerusalem. They besieged Jerusalem. Now, part of the problem, in fact, the problem with Jotham is, let's go back now, if you would, to 2 Kings 16. And again, this is the problem. We need all these details. How do we get through all this and try to get through the book of Isaiah before the rapture, right? Look over to, you know, especially since the rapture could happen at any time, right? But look at 2 Kings 16. 2 Kings 16. Hold your place, Isaiah 7. And we'll just get what we can, okay? 2 Kings 16, verse 1. 2 Kings 16, 1 says this. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remlah. So Pekah is the king of Israel, right? Everybody tracking with me so far? It says, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. 20 years old was Ahaz when he began to reign. He reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. Did not that which was right in the sight of the Lord his God, like David his father, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. So first and foremost, what's the problem going to be with Jotham here? He's following the wrong kings in terms of their doctrine. All right. I'm going to read quickly through down this. Quickly down through this. Follow along with me. He walked in the way, but walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Yea, and made his son to pass through the fire. Jonathan, aren't you happy I'm not doing it anyway? Okay. And this guy did. He made his son to pass through the fire according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel. He sacrificed and burnt incense to the high places and on hills and under every green tree. This guy's not doing very well. Right off the bat, not doing so good. All right. Then Rezah, king of Syria, and Pekah, son of Remlah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war. So you see what's going on there now, right? But look what this guy does. Verse 7. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. Who does Ahaz seek to gain security and peace and salvation from? The Assyrians. Who should he seek salvation from? The Lord. Now, again, this is the background in which Isaiah is given the vision of the prophecy of Emmanuel. God is with us. Look what's happening here. You've got the Syrians, confederate with the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom off into idolatry like the northern kingdom, and the southern kingdom going to Assyria to try to get salvation from the Syrians and the northern kingdom. Is this confusing? I mean, this Israel is an utter just abominable state and everything. And it's against that backdrop that God says, okay, ask of me a sign. And the sign is going to be a son who's born, and his name's going to be Emmanuel. At this time, it appears that God has abandoned Israel. See, Emmanuel means what? God with us. Why do they need to know that? Because it looks like he's not. And for all practical purposes, yeah, he's not. He's kind of withdrawn based upon those five cycles of chastisement, right? We're going to see some other details about that if we can proceed here. But it's against that background that God is going to give this prophecy of the birth of a child by a virgin. And his name's going to be called Emmanuel. It's going to look like God is not with us. And only those who believe God's word are going to realize, no, God is with us, not just in the general sense, but God himself is going to come. A child's going to be born. A son's going to be given. Humanity and his deity in one person. He's the one that's going to come and solve this whole problem. Okay? Now, what happens is this as well. Is that the Syrians and the northern kingdom are not successful at taking Jerusalem. In fact, the Assyrians actually whip up on the Syrians. But what happens is this then. Ahaz, He goes to Damascus. Okay, now, I know this is a lot of details here. Hold on to 2 Kings 16. Go back to Isaiah 7. Go back to Isaiah 7. Let's keep reading here. Basically, Isaiah is going to tell Ahaz, Ahaz, don't worry, God's going to take care of the Syrians and the northern kingdom. Don't worry about them. And he tells him this. Look at verse 4, Isaiah 7, 4. And say unto him, take heed and be quiet, fear not, neither be faint-hearted, for the two tails of the smoking firebrands for the fierce anger of Rezin with Syria and the son of Rimlah. Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Rimlah have taken evil counsel against thee, against the southern kingdom, saying, let us go up against Judah and vex it. Let us make a breach therein for us. Basically, they want to go and take Jerusalem, right? Thus saith the Lord in verse 7 now. It shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. Now watch how verse 8 is going to help us understand who the players are. For the head of Syria is Damascus. Damascus was the capital of Syria. Okay? That's what he's telling you right there. The head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Okay, everybody follows that. Rezin's the king. His residency is Damascus. Damascus is the capital of Syria. And within 65 years, how many years?
65.
There you go. 65 years shall Ephraim, who is Ephraim? That's the northern kingdom. Okay? Shall Ephraim be broken that it shall be not a people? And the head of Ephraim is Samaria. And the head of Samaria is Rimlah's son. What was his name? Pekah. See that? By this time in Israel's history, the northern kingdom had already become known as Samaria, and that specific territory, Samaria, was the capital of the northern kingdom. By the way, that's important when you get to the Gospels, and when Christ speaks, when John records in John 4 about the Samaritans and the Samaritan woman, and it says he must needs go through Samaria. He not only had to do that geographically, he had to go doctrinally to talk to the Samaritans because they're from the northern kingdom. All right? Okay, so at any rate, if you'll hold your place there in Isaiah 7, go back to 2 Kings 16. See how this gets difficult because time-wise and how... All right? So what happens is this, the king of Assyria does defeat Syria, and then, therefore, Syria and the northern kingdom turn away from Jerusalem. But Ahaz goes to Damascus. What was Damascus? Okay, there you go. And he sees an altar over there. Look what he does. Look at back to 2 Kings 16:10. The king of King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. King Ahaz sent Urijah the priest, and the fashion of the altar and pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. And Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made against King Ahaz came from Damascus. When the king was come from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached the altar, offered thereon. And he burnt his burnt offerings and his meat offerings and so on. You see what this guy does? He sees an altar over in Damascus. And he makes a pattern, a picture, a photograph. He emails it over to, he text messages it. He doesn't do it that right. But he sends it over to Urijah, the priest in Jerusalem, and says, build me one of these in my city. And he does. And he gets there. He falls in love. He bows down to this thing. He offers upon it. That's what Uzziah tried to do. And not only that, at least Uzziah was in the temple. This guy here, he builds his own off altar, a copy of what was in Damascus, and he says, you know, this is where we're going to offer the offerings now. Is this a problem? Major problem. Major idolatry and rebellion going on by this guy. Okay? So once again, you see the background now. Okay? And it's not good. It's not a pretty picture as far as what's going on. Okay, now, if you're in 2 Kings 16, he does a lot of other things. Now, if you would, go to 2 Kings 17. I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but in 2 Kings 17, This is the record, the historical record of the Assyrian captivity of the northern kingdom. 2 Kings 17. Look at 2 Kings 17:5. It says, "Then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria," and so on. There's the beginning of the Assyrian captivity of the northern kingdom. Everybody with me so far? In your own personal study time, read the rest of this chapter. This is, you need to know 2 Kings 17. That's the historical record of the Assyrian captivity of the northern kingdom. Now you can go back to Isaiah 7. So think about all the background of all of this. Ahaz, the king in Judah, is an apostate, rebellious king. He goes and aligns himself, makes a confederacy with Egypt. I'm sorry, with the Assyrians to gain victory over the Syrians in the northern kingdom, which he does. And then he goes and finds this altar up there, duplicates the altar in Jerusalem. This guy's in total apostasy. And not only shortly after that, then the northern kingdom is taken off into captivity by the king of Assyria. It's against that background that God says, well, if they need a sign, and they do, I'll give them a sign. And so if you go to chapter 7 of Isaiah, verse 10, chapter 7, 10. He says, "And moreover, the Lord said unto Ahaz, saying," spake again unto Ahaz, saying. So through Isaiah, God is saying this to Ahaz. "Ask thee a sign of the Lord thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above." Now watch this self-righteous guy. Ahaz said, "I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord." Yeah, you idiot. You know, this guy is completely filled with idolatry, and he thinks that that's going to fly in the face of the Lord, as though the Lord's going to be impressed with this. So verse 13, he said, "Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but you will weary my God also?" He's chastening Ahaz right here big time. And he says, "Therefore the Lord himself should," he says, "okay, you won't ask me a sign, I'll give you a sign." This sign here, not only is a sign that winds up being a hope to those who are the believing remnant, but this is an absolute chastisement in the face of Ahaz and those that are in rebellion. The sign of Emmanuel. The sign of God's going to come and clean this mess up. And it's going to take God to come and clean the mess up. He says at verse 13, and he said, "Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but you will weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." That sign there, it is tremendously good news for the believing remnant, for those who realize Ahaz is an apostate. But that is absolutely smiting in the face of Ahaz. You see how God says that in the sense here? He says, "Fine, you won't give me a sign? I'll give you a sign. You're wearying my people. You think you're going to weary me as well?" The sign of Emmanuel was a sign of chastisement against Israel for their spiritual idolatry and abominations and everything. Okay? All right. And what else is going to happen? Look, if you would, at jump ahead to verse 17 now. Again, I know I'm skipping a lot here. "The Lord shall bring upon thee and upon thy people, upon thy father's house, days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria." Here comes the Assyrians, right? "It shall come to pass in that day the Lord shall hiss for the fly," and so you can jump ahead there. Look at chapter 8 real quickly. You just have to go read all the context here. "Moreover, the Lord said to me, take thee a great roll, and write in it with a man's pen concerning," now you got to help me on this one, "Maher Shalal Hashbaz." Now how would you like to name your kid that? You know, you have a hard enough time when you're mad at your kids and frustrate your kids. You've got 6 kids and you don't call any of them by the right name. Imagine having to call this guy. "Hey, you, whatever your name is, come here." What's that? It would slow down the texting big time. He says, yeah. Now, does anybody know what that name means? But by the way, let me keep reading here for just a second. It says, "And I took unto me faithful witnesses to record, Urijah the priest, Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah, And I went unto the prophetess, and she conceived and bare a son. Then said the Lord to me, call his name, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. So she has this boy and says, okay, this, how would you like to show up to your wife and say, honey, here's what we're calling this kid? You're calling him what? How do you even pronounce that name? Anybody know what that name means? Say it loud. It means haste. Make haste. Make haste. In other words, this captivity is coming. The very name of the son says the captivity is coming.
Where does it say that, right? Oh, in my footnote. No, I remember reading it.
Yeah, make haste to the spoil. Well, in the center column reference, you can see how there's some of the references there, some of the names and so forth. But that's what that name actually means. Make haste to the spoil. Make haste. By the way, okay, I'm get off track here just a little bit. Names in the Bible are significant, right? One of the most amazing sequences of names that declare the future are in Genesis 5. It's Genesis 5, it's called the death chapter because everybody in that chapter keeps dying. But each of the individuals in Genesis 5, their name means something. And you can go through and you can tell a prophecy about the future in those names. Well, each of the names of the prophets means something. I've got a list at home. I've been meaning to bring it. I keep forgetting to bring it. But I've got a list at home of each of the names of the prophets and what their names mean. And when you lay out the prophets and you lay out what the names of the prophets mean in sequence, they prophesy. They tell a story of the redemption of Israel. It's fascinating. Well, at any rate, this guy, his son here, his name means making haste to the spoil. Verse 4, for before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. That's the prophecy about the Assyrian captivity. And hence 2 Kings 17. Now, I'm going to keep reading because I want you to see the next place where he uses the word Emmanuel. The Lord spake also unto me again, saying, for as much as this people refuse the waters of Shiloh that go softly and rejoice in Rezin and Remlah's son. In other words, that's a bad thing. They should be going after and rejoicing in Shiloh and the Lord, but they're rejoicing instead after Rezin and Remlah's son, the northern kingdom. Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river strong in Assyria. And he likens the arrival of the Assyrians to the great overflowing of a river that comes and wipes everything out. He likens it unto that. And it's against that backdrop that he says at verse 8, and he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. See, like the banks of a river overflow, and he shall reach even to the neck. And the stretching out of the wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O God, with us. Now, again, if you think of the context here, it's going to look like God is not with them. Why are the Assyrians coming in and taking over? It's going to look like God isn't with them, but that, O God, with us, is to remind us that the believing remnant, listen, God's involved in this thing. Eric, go ahead. Yeah, that's a great question. How is Emmanuel assigned to Ahaz and his generation since obviously Christ doesn't show up for, 600-700 years and so forth, okay? Well, what it is, it's assigned to the nation of Israel that they're hoping in the wrong person because, again, he was seeking to get help from the king of Assyria as though that was going to be his eternal salvation and bring in the kingdom, that type of thing, and it's not going to happen. So certainly it is a sign way out in the future as compared to in that day. All right, it's not a sign that he's going to see fulfilled in his day. He's going to die before it comes to pass. Okay. And then if you look a little bit further ahead now, saying in chapter number 8 there, watch what he does now. You can see the Assyrian captivity is coming. You can see the promise in 8:8 of O Emmanuel. It looks like God's not with them, but he is in that he is involved in bringing the Assyrians and so forth. And watch what he says at verse 9. He says, associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Give ear, all ye of far countries. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Okay, is broken in pieces, is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's a bad thing, right? So there's an association going on in verse 9 that's not a good thing, right? He says, gird yourselves, ye shall be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand, for God is with us. There's some kind of an association going on in verse 9 and 10 that's not a good thing. But there's also an association that is a good thing. Where is the good one? God with us. That's right. Now, back to your question, Eric. In that sense, you know, the fact that God is going to form this remnant is certainly good for the nation at that time. But the ultimate fulfillment of Emmanuel doesn't happen for many, many years later. Okay? So look at verse 11 now. For the Lord spake thus to me. Isaiah is like the point man for the believing remnant. For the Lord spake thus to me with strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Isaiah is told specifically, he's told Israel, when you see your nation joining this confederacy out here, making an association with this confederacy out here, Isaiah tells the nation, don't go join that confederacy. Don't go align yourself with them. We've already seen in this context here a different confederacy going on. If you'll go back to chapter number 7:2, it was told the house of David saying, Syria is confederate with Ephraim. So in the context, what is a confederacy? A confederacy is an alignment for military purposes of the overthrow of Jerusalem with the Jews and the Gentiles. And they're attacking Jerusalem is the idea. Well, Isaiah's given this prophecy here, and he's told, you need to tell Israel, don't you go join this confederacy. There's another confederacy that's going to occur. Don't you go join that confederacy. Instead, you need to do this. Verse 8:13. Instead, you need to do this. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. See, when you join a confederacy, what's implied? Why would you join that confederacy? What are you looking for? Help, security, peace, victory, conquest. And he's saying here, don't you go join your confederacy. Now, Isaiah didn't have all the details in his day, but later on Daniel's going to prophesy. And Daniel's going to tell us about a confederacy of 10 nations, 10 toes. By the way, Isaiah is going to tell you who those 10 nations are. And the biggest one is Babylon. When you get over a little bit further in Isaiah, look, for example, over to Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13, I know I'm jumping ahead here. Isaiah 13, and it says this. Isaiah 13, first verse, what's it say? The burden of Babylon, okay? If you look a little bit further ahead, chapter 15, I'm skipping some here. Look over to chapter number 15. The burden of who? Chapter 17, the burden of Damascus. Look over to chapter 19, the burden of Egypt. Chapter number 21, the burden of the desert of the sea. That's kind of interesting. Chapter 21, verse 11, the burden of Duma. Verse 13, the burden of Arabia, and so on. Isaiah actually prophesies and tells you who those 10 confederate nations actually are going to consist of. We just were not there yet in our study. But Daniel's going to come along and tell you there's going to be this confederacy. 10 toes. In the days of these kings, those 10 toes, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. So Isaiah is telling Israel, when you see your nation aligning themselves in this confederacy with anyone else other than Emmanuel, God with us, it's the wrong confederacy. Don't go join their confederacy. Let the Lord be your stay. Let Him be your fear. Let Him be your the one that you encamp with. Okay? Go back with me, if you would, over to Isaiah chapter 8 again. Is this kind of making sense? Hopefully this is like way too much information. But what's that? That's what He's doing. That's what He's doing. And again, kind of back to Eric's question, because it was such a great, and is such a great question, is how does this sign help the people in that day? Well, it helps them in that they've got to believe God's word that God is going to send Emmanuel. Okay? So go back to chapter number 8, verse 13. I won't be able to get to all this today, but we will pick up next time here, and this we'll just need to. So it says, instead of joining their confederacy, verse 13, so do this instead. Sanctify the Lord of hosts Himself. Let Him be your fear. Let Him be your dread. And He shall be for a sanctuary. That's to the believing remnant. But He's going to be for something else, for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. See, Emmanuel is going to either be a sanctuary to those that trust Him or a rock of offense to those that rebel against Him. See that there? By the way, are you beginning to see how through this section here, there are multiple verses that are quoted in the New Testament referring to Christ and His earthly ministry. Look at verse 15. Many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. And then it says, bind up the testimony. I'm going to just kind of give you a foretaste for next week, okay? Bind up the testimony, seal the law among My disciples. That's the earthly ministry of Christ with Israel. I'm sorry, among the disciples. And then He says, and I will wait upon the Lord that hideth His face from the house of Jacob, and I'll look for Him. There's the believing remnant saying, okay, here's what I'm going to do. The believing remnant is going to understand why God is hiding His face. He's hiding His face because it's the tribulation period. And then Christ says at verse 18, behold, I is Jesus Christ. It's Emmanuel. I and the children whom the Lord hath given Me are for signs and for wonders in Israel, from the Lord of hosts which dwelleth in Mount Zion. We'll look at all this next time, okay? But you see the flow here? You see the development here? Things have gotten so bad now in the days of Ahaz. The northern kingdom a few years later is taken off into the Assyrian captivity. The southern kingdom, not too many years after that, is going to be taken to the Babylonian captivity. But even in the face of all that coming, and it appears as though God has abandoned Israel, it's against that backdrop that says, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a sign. And the sign, on the one hand, is a chastening sign to the unbeliever, the apostates, and that sign is Emmanuel, God with us. But it's also a sign of hope to the believing remnant, God with us. You need to align yourself with Him. The way that they would align themselves with Him in Ahaz's day is they'd have to believe Isaiah's prophecy. Don't go join those confederacies. Don't trust in Assyria. Don't trust in Egypt. You're going to see... The southern kingdom, they're just crazy. They keep trusting in the wrong people. Even when the Babylonians start coming on the southern kingdom thinks they can get refuge in Egypt. Anyway, that's another whole story. Okay? Any questions? Let's see. The question is the word remnant used in this text at all? If you'll jump to chapter 11, 16. And again, I know we only got to chapter number 8, but really this whole section all goes together. It's a continuous. Look at verse 16. And there shall be an highway for, there it is, the remnant of His people. 11:16. See that there? There was one before that too. Yeah. It's not the exact word. Go back to chapter 6. It's not the word remnant, but you're going to see the same idea, the same doctrine. Chapter 6, verse 13, it's the last statement, of 6:13. It says, so the what? The holy seed. There they are. Okay? Shall be the substance thereof. Yes, Joseph. Yeah.
I know it's different captivity, but how are those governments divided?
Very good question. The question is, that later on with the Babylonians came and take Jerusalem and Judah and so forth, but Assyria, it's a lot of the same territory. Assyria conquers Syria. Babylon conquers Assyria, so they get all the territory. So by the time Nebuchadnezzar is in power, all nations have been conquered by him and given to him. But that's why. Okay. It's a little bit tricky to follow sometimes because of the Syria and then Assyria. But Assyria is in power, and then Assyria rises to power, conquers Syria, then Assyria comes and takes the northern kingdom, then later on Babylon, because God gives all nations to the king Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, then Babylon conquers Assyria and then takes the southern kingdom and so on. Okay? That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. And that will come up again in chapter number 10 when he specifically mentions the Assyrian, the rod of his anger. You hear us talk about the fact that the Antichrist is going to be an Assyrian. But wait a minute. Is the Antichrist an Assyrian or is he a Babylonian? Yes. Yes. Okay. And he's going to be a Jew. Well, how can he be all three? Well, Christ was a Jew, but he was called out of Egypt. He was born in Bethlehem, but he was raised in Nazareth. So it's like, whoa. So you can have one individual. I mean, I was born in San Antonio, from Texas and everything, but really we're from California. So what am I? Confused, right? What's that? A Caltech. There we go. You know, so anyway, okay, we'll pick up here next time.